Hello, and welcome to New Books in History. This is Shirley Banks, a guest host on the channel. Today we'll be talking with Trygve Throntveit of University of Minnesota about his new book, William James and the Quest for an Ethical Republic. William James is one of the United States' most far-reaching thinkers. His impact on philosophy, psychology, and religious studies is well documented. But few scholars have considered James's impact on the area of ethics and political thought. Trygve Throntveit's new book, William James and the Quest for an Ethical Republic, is a persuasive and innovative look at the Jamesian social and political legacy, especially as played out in the presidency of Woodrow Wilson. Dr. Throntveit leverages the archives of the James family, including novelist Henry James Jr. and William and Henry's father, Swedenborgian theologian Henry James Sr., to show how Henry Sr.'s ambitious but unfocused educational program affected William James's vocation and intellectual commitments. In committing to a pragmatic ethic that could accommodate varieties of religious experience, James envisioned how a democratic society should regard the individual. Throntveit reads James in light of James's personal development in relationship to other public intellectuals with whom he corresponded and was personally acquainted. The author keeps a steady eye on how William James developed as a person and as a scholar through his relationships. Throntveit's innovation lies in tracing the ways in which others applied and sometimes modified Jamesian ideas during the progressive era of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Social critic W.E.B. Du Bois, philosopher of public life John Dewey, urban theorist and reformer Jane Addams, Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, Theodore Roosevelt, and others directly responded to William James's pragmatism via their policymaking authority. In turn, these public intellectuals had the attention of Woodrow Wilson. The ideals of democracy, the ethical republic, were set in motion for the trials ahead in the Great War and beyond. William James and the Quest for an Ethical Republic contributes to William James' studies, American history, history of ideas, and philosophy. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books in History. I'm Shirley Banks, guest host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Trygve Throntveit about his new book, William James and the Quest for an Ethical Republic. Trygve Throntveit, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, Trig, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Sure. I grew up in St. Paul, Minnesota, and am now returned to the Twin Cities area. I suppose I still am the son of a theologian at Luther Seminary in St. Paul. And a very well-read former English teacher mother. And I just kind of always loved books, so I'm very excited to be on a program like this. I went out east for college and fell in love with, the world of ideas and decided to take a PhD, first in intellectual history was my focus, and recently I've kind of branched out into American cultural, social, political history, and the history of U.S. foreign relations. And currently, I'm actually in a different line of work, but maintaining my career, I suppose, as an independent scholar.
Oh, great. It really struck me that it was an interesting project. I don't think I've seen any William James material coming from the discipline of history, so that was an interesting choice. Can you tell us how you came to write about this project and what drew you to the topic?
Yes. Well, one of the things that drew me to the topic actually is that William James is written about by so many people in so many different disciplines that, you know, there was obviously not only a resonance for me, but with many other people. On the other hand, a lot of those literatures are sort of disjointed. You know, there are people who write about James from a religious studies perspective, and there are philosophies who write about pragmatism and the sort of larger pragmatist tradition. There are historians who are interested in the development of James's ideas or his role in the development of certain broader cultures of thinking and practice. And I was kind of interested in all of those. And I was most struck, I guess, by how little attention had been given to what I saw as the fundamentally moral quest or ethical concern underlying all of James's works. And so I set out to explore that and see if maybe that was a way to tie these concerns together.
Okay. So who were some of the people that, some of the faculty at Harvard who supported your academic interest from within history?
Sure. I mean, I got great support from everybody in the history department at Harvard, really, who I encountered. It was a great place to study and then to teach for several years afterward. But my advisor was Jim Kloppenberg, who's an intellectual historian and has written many, many, many articles on pragmatism and was from the get-go extraordinarily supportive. He is really the reason I ended up at Harvard. He had read my undergraduate thesis in actually a different department at Harvard and was kind enough to overlook the fact that I had never consulted him about the topic during my undergraduate thesis writing days and not hold that against me. And we struck up a friendship after he had read my thesis, and that led to me heading back to Cambridge, Massachusetts.
All right. Yeah, I think that seems to be one of the real strengths of Harvard is the interdisciplinary grazing that is possible.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, that we've got several people at the at the university and various departments who are interested in James and in pragmatism more generally. And my home was in the history department, but I benefited from conversations with people at the Divinity School. In school of government, so all sorts of postdocs and people visiting scholars. It's a very vibrant intellectual environment with a lot of really good intellectual churn. Mm-hmm. So I worked very closely with Jim. Although this was not really my dissertation topic, this is kind of a book that spun out of a larger project, but. But even with this project, both within the Harvard community and in the historical and philosophical community generally, I've had lots of good interlocutors.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, maybe with that we can turn to the content of the book. Like yourself, William James definitely had a very rich relationships and dialectical environment for his development as a scholar and as a public intellectual. Now, before we start talking about the first chapter, we should probably note that William James's father and brother have the same name, so that can get a little confusing. So the novelist Henry James is William James's brother, and William and Henry Jr. have Henry Sr. as their father. And Henry Sr. was a friend of Emerson and several other transcendentalists and intellectuals in the Boston scene. Henry Sr. was something of a theologian and mystic. And you really do a wonderful job of connecting William James's biography and family history with his work in ethics and psychology and philosophy. Can you tell us about how you make that connection with the family dynamics and especially the education of William and Henry?
Yes. I mean, I have to admit, as I may have mentioned earlier, I drew a little bit on my own experience as the son of a theologian. However, in this case, a non-mystic. My dad is not a mystic. That's not the word I would use to describe him. But I drew a lot on that experience in thinking about how Henry Sr. shaped William's thinking. First, however, I should say that I do not think Henry Jr. or the other really true genius of the family, their sister Alice, directly shaped William's thinking, except in constituting a community of really extraordinary interlocutors and arguers that forced James to unstiffen his thinking, as he would say later, in constant reaction to the views of others.
Yeah.
And I wish perhaps I had been able to test that assumption of mine a little bit more in the course of the book. In any case, I do think Henry Sr., William's father, is a different story. It's tempting to interpret his influence on his son as entirely negative, not in a pejorative sense, but in the sense that William reacted against his father's ideas. In this telling, the sort of unsettled zigzag education that resulted from his father's thinking, which was pretty confusing in emphasizing both the universe's ultimate rationality and the barrier of free will to our understanding of it, while simultaneously stressing God's desire for us to act entirely spontaneously to sort of help achieve the universe's consummation. These ideas, I think a lot of people have argued, led William to reject speculation for science, to reject predestination for freedom, and so forth. A little less common, but not at all unheard of, is for people to look for aspects of James's mature thinking, his mature metaphysics, that point toward an ultimate trans-empirical or supra-empirical unity of existence. You know, for instance, we're all sort of eddies in a universal sea of consciousness or something along those lines. I think what James learned from his father is a little bit simpler, and it's that brilliant people can be wrong, and that being wrong does not have to mean being totally wrong. Henry Sr. was not conventional, and he certainly wasn't very pious, but he was deeply religious in his way. And, you know, William, I think, wondered how did these beliefs and commitments that seemed to explain so little to him have such a hold on his brilliant dad and his dad's, you know, brilliant friends. And it struck me that in my own conversations with my dad, we often disagree on specific answers to theological questions, but we agree on the importance of the questions themselves. Now, we agree a lot more than James and his dad did, but still I thought maybe I should look for the common concerns that Henry Sr. and William shared, even in disagreement.
I think that's something that really comes through in James's sort of intellectual personality. His warmth towards even his most vigorous opponents is always apparent. And I think he had perhaps from such a rich family experience, maybe that could be a place where he learned to preserve the sense of warmth and relationship and real, you know, intellectual and relational engagement with people.
Yeah, I think that comes through in his published writing, certainly, and even in his correspondence, although he could be pretty frank in his opinions about those that he thought were sort of willfully ignoring what he was really trying to say about the nature of knowledge and truth and turning it into a sort of we can just believe whatever we want to believe type of therapy. But I think you're right. I mean, he really was, some might say almost to a fault, kind of open to the ideas of quacks and goofballs and people that others may not take very seriously. And you know, history vindicated him in a lot of those circumstances. He was a mentor to a lot of people who were outsiders in their day. You think of the famous examples like Horace Callan or W.E.B. Du Bois. So I think he really did try, at least, to practice what he preached in that way, because he was preaching it in some ways due to his personal experience.
Yeah. I'm thinking of that picture of him jokingly arguing with Josiah Royce.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that one where they're sitting on a stone fence and debating philosophy.
Yeah, out in the mountains.
Yeah.
And they were good buddies. He had amazing respect for Royce. Royce wrote a book in 1885 that James spent quite a bit of time. Well, actually, Royce wrote several books that James spent quite a bit of time just kind of thinking, well, this is brilliant, but I just think it's not right. How do I wrestle with this?
Yeah.
I think that the thing I take away from James's interactions with his father intellectually is that he was able to realize that there was something really powerful about Henry Sr.'s thinking, and that was this idea that the world is necessarily in the making or in process, and that even for his dad, the question of free will was central to understanding that process. And in Henry Sr.'s case, it was abjuring free will that was the necessary step toward realizing one's solidarity with the rest of humanity and God. And in Williams, it was not certainly not to abjure free will. But even for Henry Sr., that step was, in its sense, the kind of ultimate act of free will, sort of in the same way that, you know, God, through Christ, freely subjected himself to the world.
Right.
And, you know, for William on free will, you'll have to read the book. But it suffices to say that he viewed the world as in the making, and then human beings were agents in that process.
Yeah. So that this kind of leads us into chapter two, where the way I read it, and correct me if I'm misreading your point in chapter two, was that religion sort of emerges as almost a middle term between philosophy and ethics. You know, religion, and we should say that for James, religion meant what the individual experiences within themselves. He recognizes institutions and theologies and so on, and he respects those, but that's not what he means by religion. So is that a fair thing to say, that that religion is sort of a middle term between philosophy and ethics? Sort of the way he gets to that, away from the abstractions of philosophy and bridges into the concrete mandates of ethics.
Yeah, I like that. I hadn't thought of it in that way, but I think that does help get at what James is trying to do, which is to look at religion as a sphere of experience in which our consistent tendency and actually necessity for kind of acting on faith in order to confront a confusing world that we never completely know, is very apparent and is dramatized, but not dramatized to the extent that it becomes detached from reality in his view.
Right.
You know, here's a place where actually I think James and Dewey really overlap in some ways, because, you know, James really believes, as did Dewey, that society should make room for those who hold a variety of individual beliefs and religious experiences. Basically, James argues that all knowledge is this sort of record of our attempts to overcome problems or impediments to our interests and goals, and that truth is the quality we ascribe to those efforts that work for us. But they work in kind of the long run and without preventing us from believing in other working hypotheses that yield more important benefits. And because those other working hypotheses include the experientially validated beliefs of other people, our freedom of inquiry and our potential to flourish personally, as well as discover truths of social value, really depends on our role in maintaining a wide field of inquiry for everyone.
Mm-hmm. And you know, James himself is, I think he's being demure in, and he understates his own faith. But he is ambivalent about his own beliefs, and yet he feels so strongly that there must be room for faith.
Yeah, I mean, James, as I said, you know, James goes further than Dewey, it seems to me, in equating religious faith with the faith that is involved in all thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that faith is really, you know, the idea in a world that can be better than it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's basically this, religion for James is that idea, you know, at least in its in those variants that he considers genuinely religious rather than rationalist. It's versions of this really socially valuable notion that the current state of the universe as we experience it is not the only possible state. So religion becomes a series of tests, of propositions that are potentially useful to society. The world can be a better place. I can be a part of improving it. That depends on my actions. Actions that are useful in that regard are going to have consequences of a certain character. If those consequences are not, in fact, living up to the predictions that my religious beliefs imply, I have to revise those. But that doesn't mean giving up on religion.
Right. And that's where the pragmatism comes in.
Yeah. I think it's pretty clear James did not believe in God in any sense that is prevalent in common discourse. What he believed in was a world in which we are encouraged by experience and really, in a way, bound by our station in this fluctuating world of experience, or not our station, our own kind of fluctuating existence, to believe that we have some, that there's some purpose to our actions, and that we are both agents and extremely kind of ultimately radically responsible for our actions at the same time that we can't predict the way that things will turn out. I think for James that he thought that for most religious people it was that kind of a world and that kind of a life that religion helped them explain and flourish within.
Right. And then there's the ethical content of religious experience, which is, you know, what are the fruits, you know, in less academic language. In the varieties, he talks about what are the fruits of conversion, that's the ethical test.
Right. Yeah, if believing in, let's say, Jesus Christ means that I act in a way that implies, or rather, I believe things that imply that I act in a certain way toward others. I act to love other people, you know, in the hopes or in the belief that if I act in a loving way toward other people, that has an effect on my social environment that is beneficial to the entire community, and ultimately, my value as a person to my community and my own sense of well-being is enhanced.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is not satisfying to people who are interested in different types of much more theological questions. But that was the sort of pragmatic analysis that James applied to religion.
Right. And the one that was more available to public, to evaluation in the public sphere.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, he thought, you know, look, why should we deny people on really grounds that are shaky at best, this belief in something that when boiled down to its pragmatic essentials is useful to them and useful to other people. Now, then there's the whole question of, you know, those beliefs, you know, being acted upon in ways that are not often useful to other people, and James would not deny that there are a lot of people who think they're acting in religiously motivated ways, and their actions contradict what they claim their beliefs would imply. But that is not to confuse religion itself with a sort of selfish escapism or anything of the sort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in chapter 3, you kind of make the move it really into the public sphere in the chapter entitled The Ethical Republic. And this is something that had just frustrated me about my reading of James, like, where does this fit in the social and political world? And I just really admired the way that you worked with your sources on that in connecting a chronological reading of James and seeing how he developed sort of within his own pluralistic and unfinished life. You know, it was always an ongoing project for him. And then connecting that with the people who are around him. So what was it like to work on that project and really do that very meticulous work of connecting James's intellectual chronology with the people that that with whom he corresponded and had friendships?
Right. Well, that was, I mean, as a historian, that was really fun. I mean, that's where I'm spent most of my time in the archives and the James papers. You know, I had particular readings of James's published works that I thought very well substantiated my interpretation of James's thought. But obviously, those published works have been available to many people for a long, long time, and I thought that my emphasis on his fundamentally ethical and deliberative approach to life itself was different from many of the accounts out there. And so I thought, well, let's see what James is saying elsewhere. Let's see what James is saying to his students. Let's see what James is writing in his notebooks. Let's see, you know, who James is reading. Let's see what he's saying about their claims. Let's see how he's responding privately to some of the interpretations of his work, even while he's still alive. And let's see what kinds of concerns at a very early age and all the way through are really motivating him to pursue the work that he's pursuing. Because I think if we can figure out what his ultimate concerns seem to be, it's going to help us judge between those various interpretations of his work. If his concern is that, you know, we live in a world in which there is evil and there are things we can't control, and yet, you know, we need to live. We feel as if we're making decisions, and we need a basis upon which to make that life and that experience meaningful to us. Well, then it hardly makes sense that James is arguing that we should just sort of believe whatever we want to believe, or that we can, wish away things that are unpalatable to us. And, you know, so I thought it was very important to kind of get in his head and put his work in the context not only of the whole corpus of his writings, but in the context of his both evolving but very consistent concerns throughout his life.
Yeah. And this is occurring at a time, too, when the United States is really grappling in an agonizing way over what a republic is. Mm-hmm. and what this nation is going to be. And this is just after the Civil War. It's in the lead up to the Great War. It's a huge – well, I mean, all times are times of transition, but – and it was an urgent question.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, it reiterated for James that, you know, life is uncertain, and we are fallible people, and we need to be not just bold in our thinking and sort of masters of our environment if we can, but we need to be epistemically very humble. Because, you know, the Civil War has shown us that, our belief in kind of the sort of automatic progress, both moral and material of and political of the nation is maybe not so well founded.
Mm-hmm.
And our, you know, the strains, social and otherwise, of industrialization and a new form of industrial capitalism are indicating that certain attitudes toward our social relations that may in fact have been very appropriate at one time are no longer appropriate for achieving ends that at least ostensibly people still agree upon, the end of a society in which everyone is given maximum opportunity to develop one's potential and contribute to, you know, the broader process of social inquiry that that leads to prosperity or that leads to achievements in arts and sciences and culture. So I think he very much was responding all the time to what's going on in the world around him and in his own personal life, not in a knee-jerk way. His thinking was more consistent than that. He wasn't just changing his ideas about the nature of the universe, you know, with every headline, but he was a very reflective person, and that included that it was a type of reflection that was not as inward as that word can sometimes connote, but was very externally oriented.
Yeah, and I think that's really a strength of your work, especially for in my own background, reading in through the lens of his work on the psychology of religion. Like I said earlier, I think one of my frustrations has been, where is the connection with public life here? Because in seminary, we certainly deal with the permeability of the supposed edge between interior experience and our life in the world. This kind of leads into chapter 4, where you really kind of you start off by saying that you know, the reason that James isn't seen as a political philosopher is that he wasn't, and just kind of acknowledging that. But then you also really make a good case for how pragmatism, that specific work of James, ends up evaluating war as a philosophical issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think actually what I said was that he's not generally considered a political theorist because he was not one, but he is in fact sort of a political philosopher,
okay.
Which is to say he doesn't, and, you know, James never came up with, he was not concerned to describe in detail the ways in which polities are structured or develop or the sort of laws of their evolution and function or to predict the ways in which certain social and political structures will interact and what the outcomes were. But he was, you know, he was deeply interested in, you know, how do we understand as individuals and as a society our common goals, and how do we find ways to create the best approximation of our ideal social relations that we can. And I think that he really believed, more than most people have noticed, that our institutions and our formal political institutions, as well as informal political and social institutions, were crucial to that. It wasn't just, you know, everybody practicing their own virtues privately or kind of reforming themselves personally. It was a social problem, a social goal, and an ongoing social process. As for war, I mean, you know, he really most directly addresses that in, you know, his famous essay, A Moral Equivalent of War. And I mean, I think the short answer is that with war, like everything else he encountered in the world, he accepted war as a fact, but objected to the elevation of that fact into an absolute evil or an absolute good, or a law of human nature to which, you know, we must, you know, rather kind of flaccidly submit. Really contrary to the caricatures of pragmatism that are still prevail in some circles, but really became dominant in the 1930s, James never argued that we, as I was saying earlier, that we can will away unpleasantness. But he also didn't confuse is with ought. You know, the fact that war was didn't mean that it needed to be. He was not someone who urged us simply to manage, rather than attempt to alter those aspects of our environment that frustrate us or pervert human flourishing. You know, I guess the longer answer to James's pragmatist analysis of war is that he traced war to certain general characteristics of human psychology and social psychology. Mm. He examined war's value. I think he tried to be objective in examining war's value in terms of the ultimate ethical ends that it arose to serve and toward which it now tends to be directed, at least ostensibly. And he found it wanting in most cases, both because it doesn't serve the ends it purports to serve very well and because it destroys other more widely and deeply valued ends in the process. Mm-hmm. But again, I think he would say that's in most cases. I don't think he would say that there is never a time in which war is appropriate because, you know, it's, well, because that's not really the way James talks. I think it's, you know, the thing that is maybe most interesting to me about James and war is the way that it really demonstrates his ability to hold what seem to be conflicting ideas kind of in suspension with one another because he relates things and thinks of things functionally and historically rather than in sort of absolute and static terms. So James believes that each of us is this willful human being pursuing interests that are to some degree idiosyncratic. You know, one could argue, let's say, that a love of poetry was somehow evolved to serve a biological end, although James, I think, would dispute that. But, you know, it's hard to argue that my list of the 100 best poems in the English language and your list of the same could be described in, you know, terms of some sort of species-level adaptation or something. I mean, my top five would all be songs from, like, Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run album. So I'm sure yours would maybe differ.
Maybe not too much, actually.
the point being that we're all evolved to be willful beings, each with disparate ends in view, because the world is unfinished and there's no set pattern into which all its particulars must fall, and our freedom, you know, our ability not only to adapt to our environment but to alter our environments, depends on the chance for that true novelty in the world, and that means a chance for conflict as well. You know, at the same time, however, we're social animals, and along with this kind of pugnacious, which was James's favorite term, willfulness, we also exhibit a deep interest in social recognition for our value to our groups. And war is a great example of how a lot of the social institutions that emerge from our both our selfish and our selfless efforts to be useful to others can persist into new contexts into which they're not really well adapted. You know, war heroes cover themselves with glory by sacrificing or at least risking themselves for the good of the group, or at least that's how war is often interpreted. But in an increasingly interconnected world, James argued, that kind of archaic idea about war, or rather the archaic ideas about the groups that we serve and which serve us, and about the ways in which our interests and those of others in and out of our groups relate to one another, actually tend to encourage actions that are destructive for everyone, mm-hmm. rather than for one particular side.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think most would agree with James that even today, war does, you know, kind of call forth supreme physical, mental, and collaborative efforts that accomplish results that are really practically incredible, even if they're pragmatically undesirable. And so James was interested in thinking about how can we accept that war is a fact, but it is not a law of nature. The roots of war are facts, but the way in which we cultivate those roots is not predetermined to result in war. You know, how can we find ways to direct the psychological and social resources upon which war draws to such effect and direct them toward constructive ends?
Yeah.
And he has an idea for that, which, you know, is interesting to some and doesn't satisfy others, but, you know, his moral equivalent of war, which is kind of a civilian core, universal service in this kind of civilian core, and
right.
Environmentalists worry that it's just a campaign against nature, but, you know, his point was not to, you know, set everyone to... you know, turning pristine wilderness into oil fields or something like that.
His
point was to argue that good and evil are often mixed, and we have to be very careful and extremely creative and extremely flexible in determining communally what is the good and how to pursue the good rather than the evil.
I guess I had wondered in that chapter, and I'm looking at page 137 towards the bottom, about the what you call the deliberative process in a democracy. Through such daily acts, the deliberative citizens of healthy democracies can reduce conflict and realize the ethical republic. Such nations, James wrote, have no need of wars to save them.
So that kind of made me wonder whether war was held up as sort of the war is kind of the parable of what happens when we fail as citizens to account for the one and the many. But
yeah,
I think you're saying something different now.
Well,
I'm hearing something different.
I think I would agree with both. I mean, I think war is, you know, I think James would say war is a sign of the world's imperfection and our imperfections. But there are times at which there are, you know, war is the result of a failure to resolve conflict, I mean, mm-hmm. by definition. And it's a result of a failure to find a zone in which conflicting interests can either coexist or can be discarded for newer interests that are shared and that somehow serve the ends that the older or more compelling ends that the older interests represented. But James would say that there's no guarantee that can always occur.
Right.
And there's no guarantee that even if one group or the majority of the people involved in a conflict of interests feel that war is a completely crazy way to solve it, there's no guarantee that they're going to be able to convince
mm-hmm.
the other side. And so in that sense, it doesn't make sense to condemn this abstraction of war, you know, divorced from any context as a sort of absolute evil.
Mm-hmm.
There are times in which it, in order to preserve the deliberative process that has failed, but that could, it is still better than endless war, in order to preserve and then have a chance to improve that process, you know, perhaps other things need to be resisted. And so I think that, you know, James did see war as a terrible failing of human ethics and a terrible waste of human lives and resources. But it doesn't mean that it didn't translate into strict pacifism for him,
right,
because you always had to weigh the consequences of that,
right,
of that decision as well.
Right, right, right. Yeah. So, you know, William James died in 1910, so he did not live to see the Great War. But in the last chapter, you tether William James sort of at one end and Woodrow Wilson at the other. And in between is just a network of this sort of mesh of public intellectuals that some of them I knew had something to do with James, but others I didn't realize. So like Jane Addams, W.E.B. Du Bois, Louis Brandeis, Walter Lippmann, of course, John Dewey. That was really that connection that you made, the sort of dispersal of James's ideas into people who did have a more direct influence on public policy. That was really fascinating.
Well, thanks.
So tell us about some of the characters that are in the book and what they have to do with James.
Yeah.
And with Woodrow Wilson.
Right, right. Well, I'm not going to give too much away because that's my upcoming project.
Oh, okay.
I shouldn't necessarily record myself admitting this, but I have a manuscript delivery date coming up this year. So soon I will explain those connections in exhaustive and hopefully not exhausting detail. But,
okay.
You know, one of the things that always fascinated me about James was his ability to, it's one of the reasons why philosophers so often misunderstand him, as well as correctly, you know, chide him for being somewhat careless in some of his phrasing and things like that. But he had this amazing ability to inspire non-philosophers,
mm-hmm.
You know, and to inspire people to see philosophy as life, as just a higher, a more reflective way to live life and to act in the world, rather than as just an effort to, you know, kind of diagram the universe. So that's one of the things that originally attracted me to James and kind of, I guess, naturally then the people he influenced become very interesting. And, you know, someone like Jane Addams, for instance, who was, you know, also exerted an emphasis on James's thinking and whom James deeply admired, but admired in large part because of her extraordinarily sort of practical implementation of ideas that they shared in the Settlement House movement, particularly, you know, a lot of her other activities he didn't live to see. You know, Du Bois used, you know, kind of fused James's pragmatist analysis of the sort of historicity and contingency of our social institutions and our very ideas, our very kind of categories of thinking, to criticize race and racism while at the same time looking for the ways in which the experience of racialized groups, the strategies that have been developed to navigate life under those circumstances were still truly valuable, and how their strategies, cultural, intellectual, political, social, and the strategies even of the dominating class might or group might actually be very complementary if we could find ways to overcome the problematic barriers that those ways of thinking had erected and frankly still present. So it was just wonderful to see there were just so many examples of James's ideas being kind of put to the test the same way that, you know, frankly, if anybody's ideas need to be put to the test, it, you know, in order for us to put any stock in them, they should be James's, right? Because that's his whole theory. Of,
right.
His whole conception of thinking and ideas. So that was fascinating just in and of itself. And what I found in tracing James's influence and kind of surveying the extent of his long shadow was that of all people that I ever expected to sort of find speaking at times in really oddly Jamesian terms, Woodrow Wilson was one of them, and who, you know, my colleagues in the historical profession, you know, there will be many who will never, ever be willing to accept that Woodrow Wilson was anything but a rigid moralist, a naive idealist, a cynical imperialist, or all three.
Mm-hmm.
But I was intrigued because that's how I had been, you know, I guess, raised by my academic upbringing to view Wilson. And yet it there were just words and then increasingly decisions and, you know, and then as I explored further, private correspondence and explanations and musings and struggles in Wilson's thinking that just didn't match with any of those types of Wilson that have been kind of passed down through the historical literature. And so I thought, well, gosh, some of what he's saying really sounds like pragmatism to me, and I'm going to look for those connections. And so that's what I did, and I found that some of these extraordinarily active people that James had influenced didn't, you know, just stop being active at some weird border where politics shades into policymaking, but that they sought to be ethical Republicans in those avenues as well. And, you know, I don't know if you want me to go into the exact ways they did that.
Well, you're welcome to.
Story, but, well, you know, what I found was that really to my surprise, and throughout Wilson's career, he did have encounters with pragmatist ideas, and often very personal, direct encounters with pragmatist public intellectuals and really activists that I believe shaped his decision making at crucial points during his presidency. And, you know, what they did not do is determine that Wilson's entire presidency would be this, you know, pristinely, you know, pragmatist, you know, this crystal of pragmatist political ethics that was perfectly constructed and foreseen from the beginning and executed to every specific of its design. It was not that way at all. But I think what these people did do in their interactions with Wilson was at various points encourage well, and at various points fail to encourage, but at other significant points encourage the, well, what I personally would consider the best features of his thinking about human relations and political institutions, and really push him to push others to imagine a United States as well as a community of nations globally that interacted in a much more deliberative and, in that sense, rational way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he did make supreme efforts to try to bring that about. Now, those efforts were, in some sense hampered by his own biases, racism, prime among them, and they were hampered by, other events and external forces that in some cases he was able to master, and in many cases he wasn't. But I think we need to understand that aspect of his role, and thus the U.S. role in the period during the Great War and the peacemaking, in order to draw the right lessons from it.
Okay. Well, that kind of leads us into the question that we like to ask here at New Books Network. We've taken up a good bit of your time, but can you tell us what you're working on now? You've sort of alluded to it, but what should we look for in the future from you?
Well, you should look for those last, 7 paragraphs, I guess, that I just burdened you with. I'm working on a book right now called Power Without Victory: Woodrow Wilson and the American Internationalist Experiment. And that'll be coming out from the University of Chicago Press in 2016, we hope. Those hopes depend upon me. it's actually a revision of a project that became my dissertation, and from which this James book emerged. I have been bothered for a long time by what I feel are the sort of easy conclusions that people draw from the end of World War I and the record of the peace negotiations of Paris and the record of the League of Nations afterward. I guess without giving away too much, I'll just say that I think a better understanding of Wilson's role and the role of American internationalists more generally and the role of U.S. public opinion in that process kind of undermines some of those easy assumptions. It forces us to ask ourselves, whether it really is true that the League just couldn't possibly have worked, whether it really is true that, even if it would have worked, if the United States had joined, the United States would never have joined, or is it really true that even if the United States had joined, it would have pretty much just acted the way it did, even though it didn't join, because, mm-hmm. Americans aren't going to want their politics, decided by some group of people in all places, Geneva, I don't think there's really nearly as much evidence for any of those assumptions as has been assumed. I think there are very clear reasons that have to do with events in the 20s and 30s, and that have to do, frankly, with changes in the historiography of World War I in the late 20s, 30s, and later. That explain those assumptions better than the actual evidence from the time. And I think there's a lot of evidence for some contrary interpretations. So that's my hope, is that I will at least make the case that we should consider alternatives.
Wow, that sounds like a fascinating contribution. We'll look forward to that.
Okay.
Well, I want to thank you for being on the show today. I definitely enjoyed talking with you.
Sure, it was my pleasure. I really had a great time. Thank you.
Thank you.